Welcome, everybody. This is the second lecture for the Mises Academy class, Basics of Economics, Government Intervention. It is May 1st, 2014, as I record this. And let's jump right in. We're doing price controls and taxes, but also government spending. That's also in here as well, which may not have jumped out at you from the chapter titles, but that's also the key subject matter for tonight. So there's a lot of material here. I'm going to try to zip through it. Again, just to stress, if you're new to one of these courses, or at least the ones that I teach on the Academy, try to do the reading beforehand, because with this kind of material, I'm going to assume you've read it ahead of time, and then just try to highlight the essential points. So you'll get a lot more out of these lectures if you can get ahead of the curve and read the textbook beforehand. One other housekeeping thing, I will post both quiz one and quiz two tonight and send you guys out an email letting you know if those are up, and then also when the office hours will be for this Saturday. So you'll just get one email, so I'm not spamming you guys with those three things. Okay. So first of all, interventionism, what do we mean by that? Well, remember what we're doing in this, in the Lessons for the Young Economist, the way that book is organized, and the way, if you've been taking Mises Academy courses, we've broken it up in terms of the distribution of topics. It's that there's four basic parts. The first is just fundamental, introducing you to what economic science is and how do we conceive of the scope of economics, where does it fit in relation to other disciplines of human learning and so forth. And it's not like physics, but it's not really math, it's not really history. What is it? Well, it's economics, and how do you fit it in the broader pattern of human learning? So that's what we did in the first section, and then we studied the pure market economy, and then we studied socialism, and now we're moving on to interventionism. And so the terms we use, It's capitalism or the market economy, and then it was socialism or the command economy, and then this last major unit or section is interventionism, or what's often called the mixed economy. But let me, since this is a course offered under the auspices of the Mises Academy, let me make sure you don't misunderstand or you don't walk away with the wrong impression. Ludwig von Mises himself did not like the term mixed economy, or he thought it was a misnomer. All right, so I'll just, so you're not getting confused, plenty of people will use that term mixed economy, and so that's partly why I'm using it in the textbook, is just because it's in popular usage, and it's intuitive, like you understand what they mean, because the idea of a mixed economy is it's not really pure socialism. There is still private property, but on the other hand, it's not pure laissez-faire. It's not a pure market economy either. Under the mixed economy, people are trying to have the best of both worlds. They recognize that outright government ownership of all the means of production, that doesn't work for various reasons. All right, so thankfully, even most people today not officially believe in pure socialism or pure communism. If you ask them, they will say, you might think deep down they actually are socialists in terms of their worldview, if you want to make it consistent. But the point is, if you ask them straight up, hey, do you think it would be good to live in a truly socialist country or under a government that embraced outright socialism, most people would probably say, no, that doesn't work. The Soviet Union didn't work, and Cuba doesn't really work, and North Korea doesn't. Okay, so, but on the same, by the same token, if you ask most people on planet Earth today, would you want to live in a country where the government embraced full laissez-faire capitalism? Let's assume there still is a government, let alone, Rothbardian anarchy, where the only thing the government does is define and enforce property rights and prevent foreign armies from coming in. But other than that, it's up to you. If you can starve to death and you're not going to get any assistance from the government, if you're unemployed, tough. The government plays no role in education or in healthcare. possibly even the roads are privately financed. All the government does is have some courts and police and the army. How do you feel about that? You know, in a very small tax system to pay for that stuff. How do you feel about that? Most people would recoil in horror and say, what? That's crazy. I would hate to live in that kind of a world. Right, so they want something in between those two extremes, and that's what the mixed economy is. It's mixing socialism and capitalism. That's the idea. But coming back to what I was saying a few minutes ago, Ludwig von Mises himself did not like that term because, remember, what we said last lecture, Mises thought as long as the government allows there to be a stock market, and the other vestiges of private property, then it's basically a market economy, perhaps overlaid with heavy government interventionism. And Mises thought by calling it a mixed economy, it made it sound as if the market wasn't able to operate. And Mises thought that was misconstruing what was going on. So as long as there's still private property enough that, like I say, they allow a stock market and things like that, Mises thought it was more correct to view it as an underlying frame of a market economy upon which the government intervenes heavily and distorts things, but the market is still allowed to operate. And I think, so that's what Mises says. And just to give you an example, so he was saying the market still reigns supreme in the sense that if the government intervenes in one little area, well, then prices react, entrepreneurs and investors take capital out of that sector and move it elsewhere. And so you get all the negative effects of that government intervention manifesting itself in the response that the market exhibits to that particular intervention. Okay, so I think perhaps, so here now I'm speculating, I think perhaps rhetorically, maybe why Mises was saying that is to just drive home there is no middle ground. That either you go for full-blown socialism, which is the logical endpoint of your intervention, or you embrace the market economy. You're kidding yourself if you think there's a middle road. Okay, so I think perhaps that's why he doesn't even like using the term mixed economy, because he doesn't even want to give it a foot in the door and make people think that that's a viable alternative. Okay, but whatever the reasons for why he doesn't want to use the term, the fact is he doesn't want to use the term, so I just don't want to mislead you. But you can see how if there's the market economy and the command economy, then just by symmetry, that's why I was mentioning that one phrase to describe interventionism is the mixed economy. Okay, and then I put on this lovely portrait here, a picture here of these fine gentlemen, just to make sure. I'm sure most of you people who are subscribing to this and are affiliated with the Mises Institute, you don't need to be told this, but just for the record, again, when Austro-libertarians complain about big government and stuff like that, it's certainly not part of it. We certainly do not believe that, oh, the Republican Party is for limited government and they're pro-capitalism, and it's those crazy liberal Democrats who are the big spenders and who want to intervene. No, that's ridiculous. All of these people were both supporters of the welfare state and the warfare state. Okay, because it's another myth that says liberal Democrats are for the rule of law or for individual rights and civil liberties, and they're against war. That's also a myth, okay? Just on that point, then I'll move on to the more substantive issues for tonight. Again, so the myth being conservative Republicans are good on economic issues. You know, they're for small government on economic issues, or fiscal issues, but they're bad on war, whereas liberal Democrats are horrible interveners domestically. They mess with the economy and big business and so forth and taxes, but at least they're peaceful, right? No, that's not true at all. Richard Nixon took the U.S. off the gold standard and imposed wage and price controls. Okay, so it's hard to get worse on fiscal and economic intervention matters than that. And FDR was in charge during World War II, and Harry Truman dropped atomic bombs on civilians. And LBJ and JFK were in office during the starting an escalation of the Vietnam War, depending on when you want to start the timing of that. So, and of course, President Obama now is overseeing drone warfare even against U.S. citizens abroad. All right, so, in any event, oh, and let's not forget, George W. Bush literally nationalized major banks, which if some South American dictator had done that, the neocon press would have gone nuts about the fascist below the equator. But since it was George W. Bush doing it, it was a good thing, and Glenn Beck and Larry Kudlow were all for it. Okay, enough of my cynicism. Let's move on in the lecture. So we're going to talk about price controls. That's one of the major topics tonight. And so this, as the name suggests, this is where the government comes in and doesn't like the market clearing price that would prevail on a genuinely free market. Okay, so we, in the previous course where we studied the market economy, we walked through the determination of exchange ratios in an unhampered market. And we built up supply and demand schedules and charts and curves and so on, and so you had to manipulate those things in response to particular hypothetical changes, just so you could get a feel for, in the real world, where do market prices come from, and then what, when there are certain changes, what did that do to the market price? Not in terms of quantitative prediction, but just to give a feel for what makes prices go up or down, that kind of thing. All right, so you have you should have at this point a working knowledge of how prices are determined on the market. And so now the question is, what if for some reason the public doesn't like particular prices and politicians come along and tell them, oh, you don't like them? That's okay, we can just change them. And the way we're going to change it is we're going to threaten people who charge prices in ways we don't like. By the way, I'm being almost tongue-in-cheek or over the top here because I'm trying to break you out of the conventional way of listening to this stuff. You know, I don't want you to think of it in terms of policy wonk analysis in the way that politicians would describe it. I'm trying to get you to see, in a sense, how absurd it is. That I want you to realize there are laws of economics and market prices are what they are for a reason. And so if people just don't like it and then try to tinker with it piecemeal, it's gonna lead to all sorts of negative consequences. Right? And that's partly what Mises' point was and why he was saying that the mixed economy is not a viable third way. All right? And so let me just make a general point about the kind of analysis we're gonna be doing with interventionism as a whole. So economics is objective. It doesn't have value judgments. Okay, but at the same time, we can see the outcome of interventions is often the opposite of what the public wanted. Okay, so the strategy here, the logic of what we're doing, we're relying heavily upon economic analysis. This is the stuff that we developed up till now in the book, if you've been with us, hopefully. Or if not, if you're taking this course from scratch, just try to skim and get caught up because it'll help you. So the point is, we're using this objective body of economic knowledge to then analyze particular policies that governments often implement, especially governments in Western democratic societies. All right, and so the people in charge, if they want to justify these policies, they're not going to get up and say, these are going to be awful, they're going to make you poor, they're going to cause unemployment. They're going to give nice sounding reasons for why these are good ideas. And so we're going to use economics to show objectively, it's not going to achieve the end that the politicians claim. So just to be clear, strictly speaking, it's not that economic science per se tells us that price controls are bad or that sales taxes are bad or anything like that, because it's just analyzing what will happen if you do such and such. So for an analogy, physics is a science and chemistry and biology as sciences can tell you what will happen if you build a nuclear bomb according to certain blueprints and then drop it in the middle of a city that has 10,000 people in it. They can give rough predictions about what's going to happen. But strictly speaking, physics and chemistry and biology, the sciences, do not conclude, don't build a nuclear bomb, drop it on a civilian population. You would have to use your ethical or moral views to come to that conclusion, but you need to know the physics and the chemistry and biology. If somebody says, hey, this is a good way to, dig up some gold or something that's buried under the ground here, instead of using backhoes and things like that, why don't we just use a nuclear bomb and get down to the bottom of this and drop it right in the fellow's population? Well, no, you need the physicists and the chemists and the biologists to say, whoa, don't do that, because look at all these consequences that would flow from it. Okay, so that's what we're doing in our analysis of interventionism. We're showing that it's not going to achieve the good results that people want. And to get that, we're not smuggling in our value judgments from the outset. That's what I'm trying to get across to you, that this is objective analysis. Even somebody who really cares deeply about the poor and hates rich people and so forth, or loves the environment and the idea of commerce sickens that person, strictly speaking, if the person's intellectually honest, should agree with our analysis in terms of if the government does X, Y, and Z, these results will flow. Okay, so there's two types of price controls. There are price ceilings and price floors. So a price ceiling means that the government comes along and says, we don't like how high a particular price on the unhampered market economy is, so we're just going to announce, hey, if we catch anybody charging a price above the level we deem appropriate, we will punish you somehow. And it can either be a fine or ultimately sending armed people and grabbing that person, throwing them in jail. Or, I mean, it could even be worse. I mean, you could just cut the person's hand off or kill them, right, in some societies that force government edicts in ways that would strike us as being over the top. But the point is they just use threats to get people to refrain from charging what they would charge in a normal market economy. So for the purposes of the analysis tonight, we're going to assume that people obey the government. Okay, so it is a separate issue, and it's important. We'll actually talk far more about this when we get to drug prohibition. But for tonight's lecture, we're not going to deal with the fact that people will evade the government commands and will do stuff on the black market. We're not going to do that, right? We're not going to deal with that right now. We're just going to look at and assume that perhaps because the punishments are so draconian, or perhaps because the people in this society are very much believers of law and order and do what the government says, let's just assume that when the government passes these regulations or the rules, that the people obey it. Okay, so in the textbook, we work with a specific example. The canonical example, the standard example that economists use to talk about price controls or sorry, price ceilings is rent control. Right? So just realize there are other examples we could use in the real world. There are other examples, but a real obvious one that's popular and that everyone can intuitively grasp is rent control. So the idea is the government comes along and says, you know, it's kind of absurd that people are paying $800 a month for apartments in this neighborhood. And who can afford that? You know, that there's a lot of poor families that that's just really expensive. And so why don't we do those poor families a favor and we're just going to pass a law and say it's illegal to charge more than $650 a month for apartments of a certain size and so forth in this particular neighborhood. All right, and if we catch anybody doing it, we'll hit them with a huge fine, and the fine is so big and the chance of being caught is high enough so that all the landlords in this neighborhood just obey. They comply with the rule and they change their contracts, and from now on, they only charge their tenants $650, even though the market clearing price would have been $800 a month. All right, so that's the scenario that's depicted in this diagram, which I've just taken from the textbook, of course. So it's the market for apartment units, and you've got your standard supply curve upward sloping, so it's the supply of apartment units. So again, just refreshing our memories here, what does it mean to say the supply is upward sloping? It just means that as the price increases, you move up on this axis, well, then the quantity supplied increases, right? That's what it means for this line to be upward sloping. And again, in the real world, we don't know what the supply curve looks like. And it wouldn't. And if we did know, it certainly wouldn't be a nice straight line like that. But we're just doing this for qualitative results here. We're just trying to get across the intuition of what's going on. The argument does not rest on the fact that in the real world, we would know what the curve looks like. Okay. All we need is that in the real world, as the price of apartments goes up, the owners of apartment units would be willing to bring either the same amount or more onto the market to rent out to the tenants. That's all we really need. And then the other thing we need is that the demand is downward sloping, meaning that the more expensive apartments are, the higher the price, there are either the same amount or fewer people who are trying to rent apartments at that price. Right, so if you give me both of those things, then we reach the conclusion that if the government sets a price ceiling that's lower than what the market clearing price is, you are going to get a shortage. Okay, because by definition, this market clearing price, which I'm just picking as $800 here, but the number doesn't really matter, the idea, if that's the price at which the quantity of apartments that owners want to rent out is equal to the quantity of apartment units that potential tenants want to rent, well, then you have an equilibrium and everybody's happy. There's neither a shortage nor a surplus. But now if the government says, $800 is too high, we don't like that, let's make it $650. That's the maximum. Well, at this lower price, because we've assumed supply is upward sloping and demand is downward sloping, if the market clearing price is the one where quantity, supply, and demand is equal, well, then at a lower price, what happens? You have a lower quantity supplied and a higher quantity demanded. So you can see the argument doesn't rest on a particular shape of the curves or even that we know. All you need to know is supply is upward sloping and demand is downward sloping, or that the law of supply is true and the law of demand is true. And if you give me those two things and technically assume that there's a unique equilibrium point, then it follows that the government sets a price ceiling lower than the market clearing price, you're going to have a shortage. All right, so in this particular numerical example, I assumed at the market clearing price of $800, there were 10,000 apartment units that were rented out. So 10,000 tenants wanted to go rent an apartment, and landlords collectively wanted to rent out 10,000 units. So the market cleared. But at the price of $650, landlords only wanted to rent out 9,000 apartment units, whereas 12,000 tenants were interested in getting separate apartments. And so there was a shortage of 3,000 units. Right? There were 3,000 people who saw the going price or the going rate of renting an apartment and thought, yeah, I'd like an apartment that they're looking around and they can't find one. There's 3,000 people walking around who cannot find housing. Okay, so let me just clarify, what do we mean by this term shortage? What we mean is that, so let's be clear here. When the government imposes rent control the very next day, there's nothing physical that changed. It's not that literally apartment units disappeared or fell over or caved in. Okay. What it means to say there's a shortage now is that there are people who are trying to rent an apartment and cannot find a willing supplier. And there's a twofold reason for that in general. It's because the quantity of apartments on the market available to be rented has dropped, in this numerical example, by 1,000, from 10,000 down to 9,000. And on the other side, there are 2,000 more people now trying to rent out apartments. So you put those two facts together and there's now a gap of 3,000. Okay, so let me hit two quick things before we move on. One issue is, some people have said this, is they'll say, well, wait a minute, you haven't really, well, hang on, I'm sorry, let me back up. So what's the takeaway conclusion from this? The standard thing that a free market economist will say is, hey, look it, the government and the public think that rent control is helping lower income tenants because now instead of paying $800 a month, they're only paying $650. And so what seems to be the obvious result of this and why somebody who cares about poor people and doesn't really care about rich landlords would support this kind of legislation is that, hey, look, you're just taking $150 a month from rich people and giving it to poor people. And so why wouldn't you be in favor of it? And so the free market economist, using the kind of analysis we just walked through here, is going to say, whoa, it's a lot more complicated than that, and it's not obvious that you're actually helping poor people. So we're putting aside any kind of moral issue or concerns about the proper nature of government or the functions of government, and those are all valid objections. But we're saying, even on its own terms, if you're saying, I want the government to impose rent control because I think, you know, I would just feel better living in a world where the tenants get to keep more of their money because they tend to be poor, and the people who own the apartment buildings will rent them out and collect those rental payments each month, they tend to be richer and, you know, they don't need the money as much. If that's where you're coming from, this kind of analysis is trying to show you, hold on a second, let's actually look at what's really happening, because it's not clear that you're even helping poor people on balance. Yes, the 9,000 people who are still in apartments, it's true that their rent went down by $150 a month. But now there are 3,000 people who can't get an apartment. And so you have to ask, how are those people doing? Is it they would have wanted to be in an apartment at a higher price than to not be in an apartment at all? And so, you know, does it mean they're homeless? Well, not necessarily. They could be doubling up and staying with their friend or living with their parents or whatever. But the point is they want to have their own apartment and they can't get one. They're willing to pay the $650 and yet they can't find somebody to take the other side of that off. Okay, so even on its own terms, at best, there's a trade-off. You've helped some tenants while you've harmed other ones. Okay, so that's step one in the argument. Now, let me just clarify something just to make sure you really understand what's going on here. Strictly speaking, it's only 1,000 people total who have had, who were in apartments before and now lost their apartment. Okay, because it was all under the $800 price, the market clearing price, 10,000 people would have had apartments, and under the $650 price, only 9,000 do. So when we say 3,000 people are trying to find apartments and can't find one, there's two elements of that. 1,000 people would have had an apartment under the market clearing price. So they definitely, that's a net displacement of people who have been turned out of apartments. But that extra 2,000, they wouldn't have had apartments even before. But the issue is they, the reason they wouldn't have been in an apartment is because they would have thought it was too expensive at $800. So what's going on is at $800, that extra 2,000 people would have just said, yeah, that's too expensive. I'm just going to, you know, stay in this apartment and split the rent with my buddy, or I'm going to stay home or whatever. All right. So when you're trying to think through the consequences, keep that in mind. But when we get to the minimum wage discussion, which we're going to get to in a few minutes, keep that in the back of your head, because that doesn't mean that therefore it's a wash, okay? Because it's not necessarily the same people. Let me just say that in different words to make sure you don't get mixed up. Don't necessarily think that because originally at the price of $800 and there were 10,000 people renting an apartment, and now the price drops to $650 and we only see 9,000 people renting apartments, it doesn't mean that the 9,000 people who end up in the apartments at the price of $650, they might not be part of the original group of 10,000. It might be a different group of 9,000. I mean, there's going to be some overlap. But I'm saying in practice, it won't necessarily be the same group of people. Okay, and we're going to see the same thing when we talk about the minimum wage in a few minutes. It's not simply that, oh yeah, some workers lose their job, but the ones who stay hired get paid more. It could be a lot of the original workers lose their job and get replaced by different workers who then get paid more. Okay, so the same thing with the apartment units. Specifically, what's going on here is when they're only getting paid $650 a month, the landlords might be a lot pickier and choose different kinds of tenants. And so in the long run, it's not, you can't even say, okay, yeah, the 9,000 people that we wanted of the original 10,000, we're helping 9,000 and 1,000 got turned out. You can't even say that. It's conceivable that the 3,000 in this diagram who are now looking for an apartment and can't find it, it's conceivable that that 3,000 was from the original group of 10,000. And that of the now 9,000 who end up with housing, it's possible that only 7,000 of them were from that original group, and 2,000 of them came in because of the lower price and that the landlords preferred them for some reason to the original tenants. Okay, so let me move on, but I just want to make that point that you will often hear people say that, oh yeah, with these kind of diagrams or whatever, it's not that extra 2,000 that come in and now are frustrated. It's not really a social loss because they weren't going to have the apartment anyway. And I'm saying that's not true. Because you don't know that those 2,000 people didn't have an apartment before. They could have been part of the original group and gotten displaced by a new group of 2,000 people. That's what I'm trying to get across. One more point before I move on. You might say, like when it comes with something like apples or oranges, and it makes sense to say there's an upward sloping supply curve, and you think about it like every period, how many are produced and brought to market. And you could, oh yeah, so if the price comes down, then people will plant fewer, or you know, think of wheat or something, it's easier to switch over. Yeah, if the price of wheat comes way down, then farmers won't plant so much wheat next period or next season, and they'll grow something else. And so I could, but you might think with apartment units, you know, shouldn't that should the supply curve be almost like a flat line? Because regardless of what the price is, there's just a fixed number of apartments, at least in the short run, right? So, and that's true physically, but it's not true economically. Okay, because again, what this supply curve means here, to say there's an upward sloping supply curve for in the market for apartment units, it's saying what is the quantity of apartment units that the owners will bring to market to rent out to tenants at various hypothetical prices. It's not asking how many rooms with a certain amount of square footage physically exist. And so in particular, what can happen, like what does it mean when we say is the price goes from 800 to 650 because of the price control, the rent control? What does it mean to say the quantity supplied of apartments goes from 10,000 to 9,000? It's not that the owners literally knock down the walls and or turn the apartments into shopping centers. That's not necessarily what we mean. It could just mean that the landlords keep higher vacancies now, perhaps. All right. Or they now use some of their rooms for storage, or they use some of their rooms, they just keep them empty so that when their friends from out of town are visiting, they let them stay at that place. You know, so it's like a guest room. Okay, so there's various things, or like if you're imagining not just in terms of like a physical apartment building, but like if some of these rooms are spare bedrooms in people's houses. Right? So when I was a grad student at NYU, one of the places where I – wait, I'm trying to think. No, it was just one of the places I stayed. It was not a conventional apartment. It was a spare bedroom in somebody's house that they were renting out. Okay, and so if the price had been low enough, eventually it wouldn't have been worth it to take on a tenant. They just would have kept it as a spare bedroom for when they had out-of-town guests or something, or they would have, you know, stored all their excess junk in that room. But when they looked at the market and saw what people were paying to stay in apartment buildings down the street from them, they realized, hey, we can go through the hassle and the risk of bringing in a stranger and interviewing him, maybe checking his references and having him live with us, because we're able to get, I don't remember what I was paying, $450 a month or something. Okay? But if I was only going to pay him $100 a month, they probably wouldn't have been worth it to them. They just would have kept it spare. So that's an example. If the market price drops, people like that withdraw their apartment units from the market. So it's not that the space physically disappears, but it's no longer economically relevant in the market for apartment units. Okay. So what I just walked through, you guys, there is this first element. So what this slide is showing, and I'm just summarizing from the textbook, is to say, what are some of the major implications when the government imposes rent control? When the government makes it illegal for landlords to charge what would actually be the market clearing price for apartment units. So the most obvious and the one most discussed by economists, the most obvious implication is what I just talked about, that there will be an immediate shortage. And that word shortage, by the way, is not the same thing as scarcity. All right, so let me just take one moment and talk about that. So shortage and scarcity are different. Okay, so in economics, the terms shortage and scarcity are different concepts. So scarcity is always with us. It's pervasive. Whether you have market clearing prices or not, you can't get rid of scarcity. Scarcity just means resources are limited, desires are unlimited in a practical sense. And so there's always opportunity cost, there's always trade-off, no matter what we do with our institutional designs, with our production decisions, consumption decisions, and so forth, however we deploy our labor, we're always going to find that if we just had more resources at our disposal, we could have satisfied more of our wants or our preferences or our desires. we could have gone higher up on our value scale. So that's always going to be true. There's always scarcity. We could always use more resources if only they were available to us. We'd find a way to use them. Okay, but a shortage means something very specific in the way economists use that technical term. A shortage means if the price that's being allowed in the marketplace that people are trying to buy more units than people are trying to sell. That's what it means when there's a shortage. All right, so even at the market clearing price of an apartment of $800 a month, there would still be scarcity. Humans would be better off if magically there were just more apartments available. Okay, people have to economize, they have to make tough choices. Some people have to still stay with their parents, even though they feel silly because they're 25 or whatever. Certain people have to split the rent and have two roommates, even though they fight and they can't stand each other. The one guy's a slob and never does the dishes. But it's just because, man, you know, apartments are $800 a month. And I can't afford to pay that on my own. So I got to have this idiot as a roommate. Okay, so that's because of scarcity. It's just the physical reality, technological limitations, and so forth, that there's only so many apartment units. And if we tried to build more apartments, that would mean there'd be less food or there'd be fewer cars or what have you. Okay, that's scarcity. But the shortage is the government imposes a price ceiling, and now 12,000 people are trying to rent an apartment, and landlords only want to rent out 9,000. So that is what a shortage is. Okay, back to this list. Again, we're running through here major consequences of rent control. So we spent most of the time talking about the immediate shortage, but now there's a separate consequence, a lower supply in the long run. Now, notice I said lower supply. I did not say a lower quantity supply. Remember that distinction if you took the course, the prior course, where I really hammered home when we were going over supply and demand, that distinction between moving along the supply curve and moving the supply curve itself. So here, let's look at the previous slide. Immediately, when the government imposes rent control, the quantity supplied goes down. You move down and to the left along that given supply curve. But what I'm saying is, over time, if rent control remains in effect and the entrepreneurs see that and they think that, oh, this is going to be with us for a while, what's going to happen is they're not going to invest as much in apartment units. They're going to deploy their capital elsewhere. And so over time, fewer apartment units will physically exist than otherwise would have been the case. And so the entire supply curve itself is to the left of where it otherwise would have been. I'm not going to say necessarily that it would shift to the left, because with a growing population and stuff like that, it's possible that over time, even when a government imposes rent control on a city, it's possible that if you look at that same city 20 years later, there would be more physical apartment buildings. But the point is, in the alternate timeline, when there wasn't rent control, there would have been even more apartment buildings. So it's possible that what happens is just the rate of increase is slowed. But nonetheless, relative to the free market baseline, rent control, when it's imposed for a while and the entrepreneurs think that it's there to stay, they react. And that ends up making the supply curve to the left of where it otherwise would have been. Okay, so notice that's a different consequence. So in particular, suppose rent control has been imposed on a major city for 10 years. And then in year 11, some free market libertarian mayor gets elected and he gets rid of all the rent control. What I'm saying is there's going to be a sort of amnesia or remnant, not amnesia, the opposite, a memory of the effects of that prior decade of rent control. That the quantity supplied of apartments the moment the prohibitions are lifted is going to be lower than what it would have been had there been a free market all along. Because just actual quantity of buildings produced and things like that is going to, will have been affected. Okay. So again, notice that's a different consequence. It's the difference between the quantity supplied getting driven down versus the supply itself being reduced in the long run. Okay, another consequence, non-price rationing. So here what I'm saying is, there's a shortage. There are more people trying to get apartments than there are apartments to go around. And so the landlord now is going to have to make a decision. For every time a tenant moves out and the landlord has an opening now, there's multiple people applying and saying, oh, yeah, I'd love to live there. I'd love to pay you $650 a month. Pick me, please. And so the landlord, you know, he's got multiple applicants who are all willing to pay $650. So if we had a free market, one of the ways the landlord would decide among this field of applicants is to say, well, gee, since I've got eight people who want to live here at $650, what about $700? Do I have any takers at $700? And then some of them would drop out, and then he could keep raising the price. All right, and so in a market economy, one of the primary mechanisms by which limited supplies are allocated, if you will, is through price rationing. It's not the only mechanism. If some axe murderer says, oh yes, I'd pay $801 a month, and the guy running his local church says, well, I can only pay $800 a month, the landlord might say, I'll go with the guy from my church instead of the axe murderer. All right, so it's not that you only respond to price, but price is an important consideration in the market. The government has come along and neutered that. They've said, no, once you hit $650, price can no longer be the criterion by which you weed people out. You got to use other criteria. And so, the landlords are going to do things like they might say, okay, well, show me evidence of your work history. Let me see. Okay, yeah, I see you. Because they want to make sure that the tenant is going to pay. And so they might want to see somebody who has a stable employment history, because that gives the landlord more confidence that, yeah, if I rent to this person, let him move all his stuff and everything, I don't want him always being late with the rent or just skipping months at a time. I don't want to deal with that headache. And so I want somebody who's got a stable job. Okay, so the landlord might be more insistent on only renting to people who have a stable employment history. Or if he's got two applicants, and one of them doesn't speak English, and he does speak English, and the other one's fluent, other things equal, he might go with the guy who speaks English. Why wouldn't you do that? You know what I mean? He's got to choose somehow. Or he might choose people who come from a socioeconomic background more similar to his. Even if it's not a conscious thing, it just, other things equal, you got people applying, you got to pick somebody. He might go with the person that he just has a rapport with. So my point is, it's the very groups that the supporters of the rent control probably thought they were helping that are going to now be marginalized. And that's what I meant in this slide when I said that at the fact that there's 12,000 people now trying to find apartments and not only 9,000 are supplied, so that shortage of 3,000, we shouldn't conclude that 2,000 of them are totally new people. No. It could have been 2,000 of the original group who, for various reasons, the landlords don't like as much as people from a different group who are only going to pay $650. Okay, so let me put that in different words. You can imagine a lot of the landlords, other things equal, would rather rent to people who have long employment histories, who are native born, who are of the same race as they are, who maybe go to their church or go to their school or just, they're in the same social circles. And other things equal, they're going to be hesitant to rent their apartment units out to people who don't fit in, who can say, oh no, I don't have a job. I moved here from another city. I've been unemployed for 6 months, but I have a lot of savings and I'll pay you. But you got to give me a break here. How can I get a job if I have nowhere to live? I need to get a new apartment, get settled here. I just moved into town, and I'm going to apply for work first thing Monday morning, but I need a place to stay, right? The landlord might not want to take a chance on a person like that, other things equal, all right? Or somebody shows up and doesn't speak the language, and, you know, it's a new immigrant, and it's just like holding up the newspaper and pointing to the apartment for rent ad and pulling out, you know, $100 bills or something. The landlord might be like, whoa, this is kind of shady, no way. All right, so what I'm saying is the people he would prefer, maybe they're not willing to pay $800 a month, but they are willing to pay $650. So if the only way these people can compete with each other is through non-price rationing, well, now those other people are going to be at a disadvantage. Okay, last issue for rent control that we're going to talk about is a drop in the quality of the product. And this gives rise to what we call, at least in the United States, I don't know if there's comparable terms elsewhere, but in the United States, they're called slumlords. So the standard term is landlord for the person that runs an apartment complex, but a slumlord means they run a slum, and a slum is a term for a very low quality rundown apartment building that's where customer service is not high on the list. So think about what happens here. Imagine you own a big apartment building with 50 units, and originally you were renting them out at $800 a month, and it was a market clearing price. Okay, so you were in competition with other apartment buildings, and the tenants, if they didn't like your, you know, if they didn't like the quality of service you provided, they would go somewhere else. And if a tenant left your building, you really had to hustle and compete to try to get somebody else to come in and rent it out, because that price of $800 with the market clearing price, that was the price that just balanced quantity, supplied, and demanded. So it wasn't like there was this big pool of people waiting to fill your apartment building. And so you would try to cater to your clients. And if somebody called you at 4 o'clock in the morning and said, hey, the water heater's out, I got to go to work, and the shower is freezing, you would probably get in the car and get over there and fix it, because you want to keep your tenants happy. Okay? But if the government comes along and says, no, most you can charge is $650, and now there's just a flood of people trying to find apartment units all over the city, and you know if one of your tenants leaves because they're unhappy, you're going to have five applicants the next day willing to move in right away. Now when you get the call at 4 o'clock in the morning from a tenant and says, yeah, I got to work at 5:30, this shower's freezing, you're going to say, well, tough, and hang up on them. You know, I'll deal with it at 9 o'clock. Because worst case scenario, that tenant gets mad and moves out. What do you care? You got five people waiting to move in next week. You're not going to miss a month's worth of rent. All right. You're not going to keep putting up coats of paint regularly. You're not going to, if a light goes out in the hallway, you're not going to replace it right away, because what do you care? If the elevator breaks down and so all your tenants who live on the top floor have to use the stairs and carry their groceries up and down, you're not going to be in any rush to fix that elevator, because they're already getting a sweet deal from you. They're paying you a lot less than you think they ought to be paying you. Okay, so the point is, it's not just a physical square footage that you're providing as an apartment owner. There's all sorts of other services bundled along with renting out an apartment. And so if the government comes along and cripples the ability of your tenants or your customers to pay you, you're going to cut back on the quality elsewhere to try to restore that original balance. And what's ironic is the foes of government, or the critics of the free market, will look at a horrible slumlord situation where the person who's running this thing is a jerk and is real mean to clients and stuff and tenants. And if they fall behind on their rent for 1 week and they kick them out, and they say, see, look at this horrible. That's the market for you. That's why we got to have strict government regulation to protect the tenants. No. It's the government regulation that made the tenants so vulnerable. All right. So that's the idea. Okay. Minimum wage. Now, I spent a lot of time on the discussion of rent control because the minimum wage discussion is almost like the mirror image. So since I walked through carefully on the front end, we can go fairly quickly through the minimum wage. All right. So here, it's the opposite. With the minimum wage, the government comes along and says, we don't like the price that's being paid for a certain thing in the market. We think that price is too low. It should be higher. So notice that's the opposite of what happens with rent control. Because the wage rate is a price. It happens to be the price for labor services, but it's a price. And so the minimum wage legislation says we think some prices are too low on the market and we want to make them higher. And so in this hypothetical example, we're saying at $5 an hour, 100,000 people would have been offering their services and 100,000 or employers would have wanted to buy the services of 100,000 people. And so the market cleared. But now the government comes along and says, no, that's too low. We don't like that. We're going to help workers, help low-skilled workers by saying it's illegal to pay anything less than $8 an hour. So what happens? Well, the immediate instant implication is you get unemployment, which is what we call a surplus or a glut in the labor market. Because at that higher price, now the quantity supplied is bigger than the quantity demanded. And again, all we need to get this result is assume that the supply curve of labor is upward sloping and the demand curve for labor is downward sloping. And technically that they intersect at a unique point. That's all you need to then conclude if the government comes along and mandates a minimum wage higher than the market clearing wage, you will have unemployment. And so what does that mean? It means there are people who would be happy to work at the prevailing wage, and yet they cannot find an employer who's willing to pay them at that wage. One little nuance to this definition, what we mean in these kind of scenarios is that the workers are interchangeable even from the employer's point of view. All right, so I might say, hey, I looked at the starting squad for the Chicago Bulls and how much they get paid, and I would love to be the point guard for the Bulls and get paid what that guy gets paid. You know, I'd be happy to work for that and work at that position and start as point guard. All right, but I'm not unemployed in this sense. And why is that? It's because from the Chicago Bulls' point of view, I am not interchangeable with their current point guard. Okay, but here in these kind of analyses, that's not what we're saying. We're saying even the people running the firms who are hiring these low-skilled workers, they agree that, yeah, the 80,000 that we have working for us right now at $8 an hour, they're no better, they're no more skilled than the 40,000 people who are unemployed. It's just they're already working. We're not going to lay off one person to bring in somebody who's comparable. Why would we do that? And at $8 an hour, we're not going to hire all. We only want to hire 80,000 at $8 an hour. Okay, so that's the idea. So these workers are interchangeable in the positions under discussion. It's just that more of them are trying to find work than there are positions being offered at that higher price. So the first cut of the analysis is to say, wait a minute, are you sure you're actually helping low-skilled workers by mandating a minimum wage? Yeah, the ones who end up retaining the job get paid $3 an hour more. But now there's a bunch of people who have no job at all, and they're getting $0 an hour. So right off the bat, there's that trade-off. Okay. So that's what we just talked about, the immediate glut. And notice, just in terms of understanding the real world and empirically, that's one of the reasons you will see in the real world the unemployment rate among teenagers and other low-skilled demographic categories is typically much higher than for the population as a whole. Right? Because if there's a minimum wage, that's not going to throw a lot of brain surgeons out of work. That's not going to throw a lot of carpenters with 20 years experience out of work. That's not going to throw a lot of people with master's degrees out of work. Well, in this economy, it probably will, but you get what I'm saying. But 17-year-olds who are trying to work at a fast food restaurant, they're the ones, or trying to be busboys or something in a restaurant, they're the ones whose labor skills are not that valuable yet. And so on the market, the unhampered market, they wouldn't be able to get paid as much. So think of it this, and it's pretty straightforward stuff. If 1 hour of your labor does not allow some business to generate $8 more in profit, not considering the wage they pay you, then if the government comes along and says it's illegal to hire someone for less than $8 an hour, you're not getting hired unless the employer is just giving out charity. But you're a money-losing proposition. Now, if really what you're generating is $6 or $7 an hour worth of extra output for the firm, and they're able to hire you at $5 an hour, then they will. But not if they have to pay $8, if you're not generating that much. Okay, so a minimum wage law does not really affect people who are productive enough that their wage would have been much higher than that anyway. What the minimum wage decimates is the market for low-skilled labor, people whose work hours are not that productive and so cannot entice employers to pay them that high wage. Okay, so that's the immediate effect. We also have that same thing that we talked about with the apartment units. Here, if the government imposes minimum wage and it's in effect for a while, and then in particular if the employers think it's going to be the reigning policy in the indefinite future, they will respond in other ways as well. So the immediate response is to move downward along the demand curve, so the supply and demand strength, but also they will adjust their businesses to be less reliant on low-skilled labor. So for example, the fast food industry, and I've observed this in my lifetime, they can get by with a lot fewer workers now than they could 20 years ago. Okay, because there's all sorts of innovations where they mechanize the operation. All right, so just little things. Like when I was younger and we'd go into McDonald's and you ordered a Coke, a human being had to grab the thing, go over and push it and hold the lever, pushed it back so that the Coke came out, and they had to sit there and hold it until it filled up with Coke, and then they would pull it, come back and put it. Okay? Now they don't do that typically. Now, if you say, give me a large Coke, they go and they put the cup there and they hit the right button for the size, and then they walk and they can start doing something else while the machine automatically dispenses it and it knows when to cut it off because it knows the volume that each cup size can hold. Okay, so just that little innovation right there probably allowed the fast food place to get by with one fewer worker per shift. You might think, for any individual transaction, that's not a big deal. But no, every time a customer orders something, a human being had to sit there and for 20 seconds. Well, that's 20 seconds a customer of labor time that just got eaten up. And so now you freed that up by having the innovation of the machine that knows the cup sizes. Okay? I mean, if you see it on a certain – if you go like on an off hour or something, I mean, it could be sometimes two people in there and one person's got the headset on and is running the drive-thru. They're ringing you out at the counter while they're taking an order over the drive-thru and they're going around and there's one guy in the back making the food. And it's like those two people can crank out a lot of stuff that would have been impossible 20 years ago. All right. Another innovation, little thing, right? No, another thing is the fry dispensers that they, the utensils that they use to grab the fries, you know, it's like a metal thing that kind of funnels it into a, that's, they didn't have that 20 years ago. They had a different thing that was more awkward. It was a more generic type of utensil that was not specifically designed for fast food restaurants to quickly funnel a bunch of fries into the thing that stuff into your gullet. Okay, so now some of that stuff could have happened anyway. I'm not saying McDonald's today would have looked like McDonald's in 1950, except for minimum wage laws. But what I am saying is, given the existence of minimum wage laws, the design of these fast food restaurants had in mind economizing on labor, that they wanted to be able to produce their product for their customers while minimizing how many people they employed because the government made them artificially expensive. Okay, and so the implication of that is, even if tomorrow the government suddenly lifted all the minimum wage laws and got rid of them, you would not see a humongous surge in employment among fast food restaurants, right? And so it's funny, you could imagine if for some reason they did do that, you know, there was some libertarian awakening and a bunch of mayors and or state legislators get elected across the country. They get rid of the federal minimum wage law and the state legislators get rid of their thing, and wages in the fast food industry drop by 20%. And you might not see this humongous surge right away. And you can imagine Paul Krugman and Brad DeLong and other guys going, "See, we told you, you morons." But it's partly because the restaurants have now all been designed to be able to produce without using teenagers. Instead, now the strategy is to have like one manager in charge who's older, and then maybe a few teenagers who are pretty competent. Okay, whereas before it might have been more like a whole boatload of people that weren't very skilled, but they were cheap. Okay. Another implication, non-wage competition. So again, you can't even say that the reason or that, yeah, sure, of the original pool of people working, now some of them lost their jobs, but the ones who remain at least get paid more. And so that's the trend. You can't even say that. It's possible that a lot of the original pool of workers gets laid off and new people come in because the employers prefer them at the higher wage. All right. And so, for example, maybe here, just to go refresh your memory what these numbers look like, at $5 an hour, maybe it was only the desperately poor people that were working. I mean, I'm exaggerating here, but just so you see the point. The people who really needed, that maybe it was their second or third job, or maybe it was teenagers who came from a poor background and their family really needed the teenager to have that job to bring in some extra income. But at $8 an hour, now maybe there's a bunch of white suburban kids who are home from college for the summer who say, yeah, I'll work at McDonald's for $8 an hour over the summer. And maybe the manager of that McDonald's would rather have the suburban college kids who are come from good families and blah, 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 working at the store rather than some kids who take the bus in from the city to work there at $5 an hour. Okay. And so again, it's the opposite of what many of the proponents of raising the minimum wage have in mind. They might be actually pricing out of the market the very people they think they're helping. Okay, and the last thing we'll discuss on this topic is a drop in workplace quality. So here, again, when it comes to an employment contract, it's not just, oh, you sell me some hours of your labor and I'll give you money. That's the end of the story. No, there are other things involved. And so it could be things like, maybe originally, in order to attract workers, the company would, yeah, they'd only pay $5 an hour, but they have a nice break room with a TV and stuff and a nice water fountain that had real cold water and a bathroom that was clean and a vending machine that was well stocked. And they would give, you know, the employees, if they went 10 or 15 minutes over on their lunch break, the boss didn't go nuts. You know, so it was a pleasant place. Where now all of a sudden, no, you're paying the employees $8 an hour. Maybe management is going to tighten the screws. Maybe they're not going to, you know, they're going to get rid of that vending machine because that wasn't a moneymaker. That was there for the convenience of the workers. Maybe they're going to be real sticklers now about, no, when your lunch is over, you get back on the assembly line. You stroll in 5 minutes late, we're docking you for a half an hour of pay, something like that. Okay, or if you show up late 2 days in a row, you get fired, whereas before they might have been more lenient. Okay, and why is that? They can afford to be tough guys now because for every job opening, they have a bunch of applicants. And so the employers have to crack down some other way, and they got to save money in other ways too. So when it comes to picking the total compensation package, they might reduce other areas because now they're having to pay more. And so you can come up with scenarios where even the workers might be worse off, even the ones who keep their jobs. So my point is, it's not just that, oh, yeah, when you raise the minimum wage, you help some workers who retain their jobs, but you hurt the ones who get laid off. No, even the workers who retain their jobs, it's not an unmitigated benefit to them. The job they keep now is probably worse, although admittedly it pays more. Okay, so even their gain in terms of the monetary gain is partially offset by the fact that they're probably going to have a worse job, other things considered. Just like with the landlord or the apartment situation, you can't even just say, oh, yeah, well, the people who got to still stay in the apartments gain $150 a month, and then admittedly some people now can't find an apartment. Even the people who stay in the apartments aren't as good as they used to be. They're cheaper, but the product they're getting is worse. The paint peels and the elevator isn't kept in good working condition. Maybe there used to be a doorman, you know, that was there mostly for security to make sure riffraff don't come in the building and stuff. And now maybe the landlord lays that guy off because it's just not worth it. Okay, so the product you're getting under price control, price ceiling is worse, and the job you have under minimum wage laws, price floors, is worse. Okay. The recent controversy over minimum wage laws. Here, there's been a lot of empirical work trying to suggest that in practice, if you adjust for certain other factors, you run regression analyses, it looks like perhaps the quantity demanded of labor does not fall very significantly in response to modest hikes in the minimum wage. And so this is behind a lot of the recent revisionism where people are saying, like Paul Krugman and guys like that are going, oh, it's a myth. We can raise the minimum wage. It won't throw a lot of workers out of work. That's just a right-wing myth. So there is a lot of empirical work, and it's involves a lot of high-tech stuff, regression analysis. The prima facie, if you just run a simple, naive regression and say when they raise the minimum wage, what happens? Yeah, it does look like there's an obvious correlation between hikes in the minimum wage and a reduction in employment. But it just so happens that a lot of the places where those experiments occur are in states where people are, like, they're in northern states that have a poor climate or something. You know, so people are moving to Florida and Texas, and Florida and Texas have lower minimum wage laws. And so, you know, they're arguing there are other things going on. Okay. So one response to all that, and that's what I did with this diagram right here, is to say, fine, suppose the diagrams look like this. And then you would see empirically, as they raise the minimum wage from the current level of $7.25, up to where Obama wants to raise it, $10.10 an hour, suppose that demand curve really is very steep, such that you can see here, even that jump in the minimum wage isn't going to actually reduce the quantity very much. It's only going to go from 2 million workers down to 1.998 million workers. Okay, so that's a very slow, 0.1% drop in employment. So these guys like Paul Krugman would look at that and say, see, we didn't really distort the labor market and give a huge boost in pay to these low-skilled workers. But the point is, still, as long as the supply curve is normal, you're going to get this big increase in people trying to find work. And again, you can't just assume that these unemployed people are going to be newcomers who wouldn't have had a job anyway. They might have been part of the original group who were employed at 725, and now they get laid off because now other people want to work at 1010, who before said, no, I'm not going to work at 725. And the employers might prefer those other people because maybe they have college degrees or whatever. Okay, so again, even on its own terms, even if you bought all the empirical stuff saying that in practice a big hike in the minimum wage won't actually cause a big fall in total employment, it still screws up the labor market in the ways we've discussed. So that, again, that's why I drew these curves. So I, in case you're getting lost, I purposely drew that demand curve very steep because I wanted to show a situation where even a sharp hike in the minimum wage led to a pretty small quantitative drop in total employment. And that's what happened in this particular diagram. But notice, you still get a distortion in which workers get hired. Okay. Let's, I don't have that much more to say. So I focused on those two topics because I thought that's where I can really concentrate. The other stuff, you know, obviously read the textbook for the full story, but a lot of it's pretty self-explanatory. So let me just, I'll whiz through these last few slides and then I'll turn to your guys' questions for tonight. Okay, government spending, there's three main vehicles by which the government pays for spending. It can either explicitly tax the population, it can borrow the funds, and that's what we mean when we say the government runs deficit, has a budget deficit, or it can turn to the printing press. So those are the three main ways it spends or pays for its spending. And notice the reason I put this tank here, however the government gets the money, when it spends, it withdraws real resources from the economy. Okay, so I'm trying to get you to realize government spending in and of itself distorts things. It doesn't matter how they came up with the means to pay for it. The fact that there are politicians and bureaucrats who decided we're going to make a bunch of tanks or we're going to pay a bunch of contractors to produce tanks, that means necessarily the steel and rubber and electrical components and other things that went into those tanks could not go into other things. So there are fewer cars now, civilian cars that can be built because these tanks were built instead. And the labor hours that went into making these tanks now cannot be used to build motorcycles for civilians or to build apartments. Okay, so in that respect, government spending per se reduces the amount of private output. Okay, now, when we think about taxation, don't just think in terms of, oh, these are various ways that the government sucks money out of the private sector and that's what makes them poor. It's, I mean, that is true, but it's more than that. So the way to remember this point is to say, suppose the government comes out and says, we're going to impose a 300% sales tax on 1% milk. All right, so if you go to the store and try to buy milk that's 1%, you know, 1% milk fat, then when you go to the cash register, they're going to add a 300% surcharge on that. But if you buy skim milk or 2% milk or whole milk, there is no such surcharge. So the government's probably not going to raise very much revenue from that tax because most people are probably just going to either switch to 1% milk or 2% milk or skim, or they might buy both and mix them together rather than buying the actual 1% cartons and then get that 300% tax. Okay, so since not many people are going to actually be doing the behavior, it's getting hit with that huge tax, the government's not going to raise much revenue. But it would be wrong to conclude, therefore, that, oh, well, the government's only making a few million dollars a year off of that, so it's probably not that very distortionary. No, it might be very distortionary. Okay, that people now who wanted to buy 1% milk can't or choose not to. Okay, so again, when you're trying to assess the economic impact and distortion of a tax, don't just think, oh, well, it's sucking a certain number of dollars out of the economy, and that's the cost. No, it's not. The actual economic cost of the tax or damage of the tax is that it alters people's behavior and makes them do things that they wouldn't otherwise do, and so they're all worse off because the government forced them to change their behavior. Okay, let me make a few points here. But again, this is standard stuff, and you just read the textbook, so I'll be quick about it. Sales taxes, if they're applied unevenly, so that some goods and services get hit with a really high sales tax while other ones don't, well, then obviously part of what's going on here is the government is distorting the relative prices. It's making some goods and services artificially a lot more expensive, and so that's limiting people's choices. It's making something artificially more unattainable than it really should be. And you see this in particular with what's called sin taxes, where the expressed purpose of the tax is not to raise revenue, but rather to change behavior. So that's just clear paternalism, where they say, we're going to tax cigarettes or liquor or whatever at a very high rate, and one of the ostensible justifications is we don't think people ought to be doing that stuff, and so we do want to shut down the behavior. Okay, or I should say that's the official reason. I think actually it is about revenue, but they will say openly we're doing this because these are vices and people would be better off if they didn't do it so much. Okay. Notice, however, though, that even if you did have a uniform sales tax applied equally to all goods and services, that wouldn't be neutral. That would still distort things because you would still have the prior decision when people decide, okay, how much do I want to work? Or how much do I want to engage in leisure? And so if you realize any money I get paid, any wages I get paid for my work, when I go to spend that, everything is hit with this uniform sales tax. That makes it less attractive to go earn wages to then be able to buy stuff. And so I will choose to engage in more leisure, and I will work less because of a sales tax. So notice here, even a tax that's not applied to my income or to my work directly, still the tax is applied to the goods and services that I buy. Nonetheless, that funnels back and can distort how much I want to work. Okay, income taxes are directly applied to income, as the name suggests. Make sure you understand the distinction between marginal and average tax rates. And this, generally speaking, it's silly when people say stuff like, oh yeah, I got a new job and I got a raise, and so now I'm paying more in taxes, and so actually I'm poorer. Generally speaking, that's not true. That usually, if you get moved into a higher tax bracket, that higher marginal rate only applies to the portion of your income that's in the higher bracket. So your total tax bill typically does not go up just because your income goes up. Now, I say typically because there are weird things with certain government rules where actually there are zones where, certain things phase out and whatever, and you actually – your marginal tax rate is over 100%, but that's unusual. There's this thing called the Laffer curve that says at some point increasing the marginal tax rate so much reduces the tax base that the total revenue the government collects goes down. And so Laffer apparently illustrated this on the back of a cocktail napkin to somebody in a restaurant and said that it's, you know, the way to see it is, look, at a 0% tax rate, the government obviously takes in $0 of revenue. But at a 100% income tax rate, the government would also take in $0 in revenue, or very close to zero. Right? Because why would anybody work and earn income knowing that they had to turn over every last penny to the government in the form of income tax? You just would, you'd stop working. And so Laffer's saying, so in both extremes, the tax rate of 0% or 100%, government revenue collected is $0. And we know it, intermediate points of the percentage taken, the government collects a positive amount. So clearly, there must be some region where raising the rate, the percentage rate of the income tax, actually makes revenue go down, and vice versa. So if you're in that region, the government can actually lower the tax rate and bring in more revenue. And so that's the whole argument over the Laffer curve and people talking about self-financing tax cuts and so forth. Okay. Another thing you'll often see in the discussion of taxation comes out of the Chicago School approach, and a lot of free market economists talk like this, and they'll say the income tax is particularly insidious because it penalizes savings. Because what happens is you earn your wages, you pay tax, income tax on it. Now you can consume it. You can go, you know, buy TVs or go to the bar or go to Vegas, and that's fine. But if you choose to save it, then next period when you earn your interest income or your dividends or your profits or whatever it's classified as, the government's going to hit that income again and tax it. And so in terms of the intertemporal trade-off, the government is penalizing savings. It's giving you, it's giving an incentive to consume sooner rather than later. And so that's why a lot of free market economists favor consumption taxes or sales taxes on consumption goods, retail, rather than income taxes, because they're saying, yeah, all taxes distort, but income taxes are particularly insidious because they not only make you want to work less, but they make you want to save less. Okay, and then the final thing, and I'll turn over your questions. I realize I'm running out of time here. Let me give you the Austrian spin, by which I mean things that Austrian economist Murray Rothbard might say in response to some of what I just went through. Because what I just went through was pretty standard free market economist analysis of taxes. So one thing Rothbard brings up is, why is it that whenever the standard free market Chicago school guys talk about tax reform, they usually use revenue neutrality as the benchmark? So they usually will say things like, hey, you know, holding the total amount of revenue collected constant, it would make more sense if the government got rid of the income tax and replaced it with an 8% sales tax. And you'll hear economists say stuff like that. So Rothbard will say, why do we have to hold government revenue constant? Let's drive that down. Let's have tax reform that starves the government of funds. Okay, so that's a Rothbardian kind of point. Similarly, he will say, in reference to what's called the Laffer point, is the percentage income tax rate that maximizes government revenue. And so the idea is, clearly, if you're above the Laffer point, where the government is charging such a high tax rate or assessing such a high tax rate that it's collecting less revenue, then it should be a win-win. And so Rothbard is saying there's nothing special or ideal about the Laffer point. I don't want to maximize government revenue. Okay. Incidentally, in some contexts, Arthur Laffer himself will say the same thing. That, you know, so Laffer does not necessarily say I am in favor of the Laffer point. His point was, or his perspective was to say, if we think we're beyond the Laffer point, then clearly that's crazy. Let's cut tax rates, because that should make liberal democratic big spenders happy because they get more revenue, and it should make conservative pro-business people happy because then you know, people have more money to take home. Okay, the last thing Rothbard would point out is you got to be careful in the way you phrase your objection to the income tax. It's not that economists ought to be favoring saving and investment per se. So a lot of times when you hear mainstream economists talk about tax reform, they'll just say matter-of-factly, well, we want to promote savings and investment, and so that's why we should get rid of the income tax. And so Rothbard is saying, well, no, really what you want is just to have the market respond correctly to people's time preferences. And so you don't want to artificially penalize savings, but you don't want to use the tax code to promote it out. Okay, let me stop there. Let me just field one of your guys' questions. Okay, there's nothing in the Q&A box. Okay, well, good. That worked out well. It doesn't look like you guys have any. You're just chit-chatting among yourselves. Okay, great. That worked out fine. Okay, so that's the last thing here. Let me just add. There is okay. I see Jan has one question. I'll deal with that, and then I'll let you guys go here. Jan says, "You said last week that Hayek admitted you could do economic calculation if you did a million equations. Do you agree?" Okay, let me just clarify what Hayek said. In the socialist calculation debate, if you look at the actual journal articles, you know, so Mises launched his salvo, and then people responded. In particular, at one point, Lange and Lerner offered the so-called market socialist response, and they said, look, just take the equations from mainstream price theory that describe the equilibrium allocation of resources in a market economy, a decentralized market economy. The socialist planner can just use those equations, plug in the right numbers for the variables and stuff, solve that thing, boom, and you've got your equilibrium price vector. And then they can just announce that to all of the factory managers and say, these are the prices you ought to be using. And so we've solved Mises' problem. We don't need to have private property. We can come up with a system of objective exchange ratios among material factors of production to show how much is a ton of steel worth compared to bushels of flour. Because you need to know that kind of stuff to be able to make correct allocation decisions. Knowing the technological trade-offs, you need to know what's the economic importance of these things. And so these guys said, look, we can use mainstream economics and come up with a system of simultaneous equations and solve it. Boom, there you go. And so Hayek, in his response, said, okay, yeah, that would work in principle, but come on. In practice, you would need supercomputers that, you know, well beyond the capacity of what we have. You wouldn't actually know in real time what numbers to plug into these equations because knowledge is actually dispersed. Okay, so Jan, to answer your question, that's what Hayek said. So he kind of conceded the theoretical point, but then said, give me a break, you guys. In the real world, that wouldn't work. Okay, so Jan, for me now to answer you, I disagree with Hayek because, and that's actually what my paper is, the one that I linked for you guys. It's in the syllabus. It's not a signed read. I just wanted you guys to read the first four pages, I think, or the 4 1/4 pages. But if you want, you can read the whole thing, where I go through my point in that paper is to say Hayek conceded too much. That it's not just that in practice it would take a large number of equations, it would actually be an uncountably infinite number of equations to actually implement the solution, and then even in principle they couldn't do it. So it's not merely a pragmatic objection. What they said they would want to do wouldn't work even in principle. That was the point of my paper there. Okay, I will stop there, guys. Thanks for tuning in, and I will post both quiz 1 and quiz 2 later tonight, and you'll get an email saying all that stuff. Thanks, everybody.